But I think now you're joined, I believe, by Fred Anderson. Are you there, sir?
Yes. Can you hear me, Phil?
Yeah, I can. I'm looking at Pedro. I think we're getting you loud and clear, which is we're very happy about that. I want to use your book, if we could, for a discussion of all of our little problems with democracy in North America. The book is Eyes Have Seen, from Mississippi to Montreal. And Fred Anderson has lived the life which helps us understand our times. And he attended Sir George Williams University, won the Board of Governors Medal for Creative Expression in the Literary Arts. He was instrumental in co-founding two black research institutes as well as a black literary forum. Later, he worked in northern Quebec in the service of Inuit and Cree adolescents. Fred Anderson lives in Montreal. I wonder if you have the same kind of, I guess the expression, deja vu, with what is going on in the world today. You were at ground zero for the great struggle in mid-60s to actually obtain the right to vote in the United States, whose constitution guarantees equality, et cetera. And yet it was legally segregated, legally, by the states of Mississippi, et cetera, the South, Deep South. And that battle was, I think we could say, won to a degree, and largely through the efforts of your organization, the SNCC, SNCC, and others. And now years have gone by, and there seems to be an erosion of what you achieved. I'd like to get your reflections on that. Your book is, by the way, sets it up perfectly, it's in my mind, to understand how hard it was to get the right to vote and also to elect people, but now to find ourselves with a pretty hostile presidency and a Congress that doesn't seem to care that much. Can you tell me how it's going in Mississippi today? I'm reading that there have been maybe three Democratic Party leaders who are actually winning the right, trying to establish and increase black representation. And Hattiesburg is where you're from, is one of those places. Pardon all this talk, but how do you feel about that? And is it accurate to say that there's been a terrible erosion?
Well, where there most definitely has been a terrible, horrendous erosion of all kinds of gains that were paid for dearly, paid for very dearly, and sometimes fatally. You know, I think there's all the noise of the right wing MAGA echo chamber that's taking up a lot of space. I think one of the things that's clear to me with people that I remain in contact with, who continue to do very serious grassroots work, is that under the radar, there are people who still have their nose to the ground, and they're plodding ahead with building the resistance to try to put the brakes on some of the most egregious setbacks that are happening at local levels, especially across the southern United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if we could tie it to some personalities, Eunita Blackwell, who plays a prominent role in your book. By the way, everybody should get this book because it's so poignant, and you really have such hopes for it, because You met Eunita Blackwell, and she was became a, as a result of all the struggles, she became something of a force in the Democratic Party, I believe, and she became a mayor and those things.
Yes.
And so, could you tie the two stories together? How did you know her, and what are the folks around her now?
Well, I got to know Eunita Blackwell because when I was sent on my first mission as a SNCC secretary, organizing in the Mississippi Delta, I was sent to Mayersville, Mississippi, which is her small hometown. Mm-hmm. And she's actually the one that housed me and that I worked with closely to register voters in Mayersville and other black Mississippi towns. You know, but I'm glad you focus on people like her, Phil, because one of the things that I wanted to do with the book is to try and look in the reverse mirror. And what I wanted to do, not in any effort to diminish them, but I wanted to dim the lights on what people ordinarily think of when they think of the civil rights movement. I wanted to dim the lights on those sort of like Oscar winner nominees. And I wanted to raise the light on the support actors who were really the backbone of the movement. And I think if there's one lesson that people need to hold on to is the importance of the support actors, the local leadership. And we were able to make those gains because we had such great local leadership supporting cast across the South and in some instances across the United States. And I think what we're falling back into, and this was in some ways justified, much of the civil rights movement before the advent of SNCC was grounded in major rallies, major demonstrations in response to some of the oppression that was taking place. And that was worthwhile in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that we learned is that if you do not have local activists, people who are willing to embed themselves in community and continuously till the soil of local leadership and making sure it was sustainable, then I don't think we would have had the kind of movement that we had and achieved the kind of gains that we ultimately achieved.
Yeah.
And I think that when we look at all of the dystopian, Trumpian stuff that's going on, the resistance too often is in a reactive mode, you know, instead of taking the front and running with it continuously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it strikes me that the role of SNCC, the philosophy was quite brilliant, actually. You're living testimonies in the book, but it's in a way you start, you know, use the old expression, you were a spark, but it turned into a prairie fire or an avalanche. You found yourself, and so did Eunita Blackwell, that the people began to take it up, and the young people, and you actually found yourself in a dilemma because, as I understand it, the leadership said, look, we're here to do what we do, and we shouldn't get involved because young people started coming to you and say, well, we're going to boycott the school, or we're going to do this and that, and you weren't sure what to do, right?
Well, that's true. And you know, and often that's what happens when you develop local leadership. I mean, they oftentimes take over the strategy. They own the agenda, and you have to in some way reconcile that. But you know, the philosophy of SNCC was never to dictate or tell local people what to do. I mean, you know, even in instances where we disagree, we had to find ways to support them.
Yeah, there was that experience where it's very vivid in your book. By the way, it's Eyes Have Seen. Please get it. It's clear that the students were going to do this, and there were some in your camp, that was SNCC camp, and others who said, you know, these kids could get hurt, right?
Right.
It puts you in a different. And well, you did resolve it. Basically, it was it sort of turned into they're going to do this. Some of our people will trail along, I guess. But you decided to get out of their way and let them go ahead and make their own decision.
Absolutely. And to join them and provide as much support as we could, but also keeping in mind that it was their action and their agenda, and we needed to let them be in the forefront, support, and not take over or try and dictate or push it in one direction or other.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Fred Anderson, Eyes Have Seen. By the way, what song is that from? Eyes Have Seen the Glory, et cetera. It's like I hear half of a song in that title.
Well, there is. I mean, there are a number of spirituals and gospels that refer to that. But I was at a speaking engagement last Thursday night, and where it really came from, I was explaining to the audience about my grandmother and the pivotal role that she played in my life. And I was talking about the fact that when I was a young boy, I would accompany her in the woods where she would collect berries and barks from trees to make different healing ingredients. And she always had so much respect for the tree. She prayed for the tree. She sang to the tree. She talked to the tree. And one day as a little boy, I asked her, "Grandma, how come you talking to the tree?" And she responded, "Well, I talk to you, don't I?" and she said, "Well, this tree has been around much longer than you and me. It'll be around much longer after we've gone. It's withstood lightning. It's withstood flash floods. It has seen more than you and I will ever see."
Oh boy!
And so that's how I came up with that title.
Yeah, you came up with a smart grandma. So
yeah,
I'm talking to you, aren't I? I like that. Now another thing, one last thing on this SNCC. Who do we attribute the name? Bob Moses seems to be at the center of this concept of empowering people, not being leaders, but training leaders or helping leaders develop. Was that
right?
Have you studied how this idea came to be such a tickle?
It was a woman named Ella Baker,
mm-hmm.
who came up with the idea of SNCC. She had been an organizer of Dr. King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and then when the Freedom Rides and all the sit-ins of these young people burst onto the scene, Dr. King sent her out to conference with these students to see how these students could become involved in his organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Hmm. And Ella Baker quickly realized, no, that's not the best route. These young black students need an organization of their own. Hmm. And so she's the one who guided the philosophy of local grassroots leadership, mm-hmm. of SNCC people being organizers, not leaders.
Mm. That's a very sophisticated strategy, I must say. Ella Baker, she's quoted, I believe it's in your book, I've seen it somewhere, she talked very much about being real and not having illusions, but being able to carry on in the face of what reality tells you, which is tough project.
Exactly. She was a remarkable woman, and she is of late, getting her due. People are now writing biographies of her life. There's some film documentaries, and one of the most beautiful songs you'll ever hear is by the group Sweet Honey in the Rock, and they have a song called Ella's Song, which really sums up her approach.
Well, we're going to find out and play that, if not today, regularly. speaking of remarkable women in this problem, there's, of course, Fannie Lou Hamer, with whom you worked, and, of course, Eunita Blackwell, if I understood it, was inspired somewhat by Fannie Lou Hamer.
Absolutely.
And so here's the problem, the Democratic Party. And how to relate to it. And you were right in the middle of this. This is the decision to register voters, but then the Democratic Party seemed a little cool toward you. And the question was, challenging the set leadership, the in concrete, of Southern Democrats who went off to conventions and excluded black Americans. So That struggle was engaged, and I believe you attended, did you not, the convention, the Democratic Party convention in New Jersey?
I did the 1964 Democratic National Convention. You know, the thing with political parties, they'll never embrace anything wholeheartedly that's controversial. Unless you create the conditions that force them to do that. And we were able to successfully do that to a degree. And you see that now being played out in all the political parties, but especially when you look at the Democratic Party, which people have always viewed as the progressive party, cooperativism has completely, to untold degree now, usurped that party. And you see it playing out between the progressive wing and the conservative wings of the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm. And it's, of course, this is, I think, has returned as an issue today. That's why your book seems to me so relevant to understand. Because one of the things that in reading your book, it becomes clear is that at the end of the day, they assumed you have no choice but them. And so they played this game. Could you describe it? Fannie Lou Hamer came, and she led the Freedom. Was it Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party? And she said, well, we should be the ones seated because we don't discriminate. These other Democrats, so-called, do.
Right.
A lot of people were
upset because they assumed it was a failure not to accept the compromise that was being offered by Lyndon Johnson and the Democratic Party. And I think Fannie Lou Hamer was wise enough to see that the whole premise of the Mississippi Democratic Party was not to succumb to traditional politics. Mm-hmm. We're not here for traditional politics. We're here for a new kind of politics.
Yes.
And we therefore say no to your compromise because we will not be compromised.
And isn't that where they are right now, where the party leaders are trying to manipulate everything? And people are saying, No, we have we have to put this party on a different road.
Absolutely.
If you could, I mean, one of the terrible things to read, terrible, is it part of the problem of we have American heroes, liberals, et cetera, and among them are, well, of course, there's, Hubert Humphrey. Now, I laugh at myself for saying this, but you describe a situation where actually all the leaders, and I guess it's because LBJ, who was the boss of the country, was calling them all up, but if I understood it, he involved Martin Luther King and Hubert Humphrey and Walter Reuther in trying to convince you folks to go to go along with Lyndon's plan.
Yeah, well, there was a lot of pressure to try and accept Johnson's compromise, and he very much wanted Dr. King's support on that. And so he set up a meeting with Dr. King and Walter Reuther, who was the powerful president of the United Auto Workers.
Yeah, he was involved in the March on Washington, et cetera.
Exactly. But he was also, but his union was also the primary funder of Dr. King's organization.
Mm.
And so Reuther ruthlessly threatened Dr. King that if he didn't fall in line, then they would withdraw their funding.
Wow. The pays the piper, calls the tune, right?
Yeah.
What an ugly situation. But thanks to the wonderful spirit of course, SNCC and others and the rank and file, Fannie Lou Hamer said, they said, well, we'll give you two seats. Is that right? And by the way, those were observer seats. They weren't voting seats.
It was two seats at large. They were not voting seats. No.
And Fannie Lou Hamer said, we didn't come here for two seats.
We didn't come all the way up here for two seats.
So you're, again, we got to remind everybody, you must have been what, 19, 20 years old?
At that time, 17.
I got
involved when I was 15.
I'm going to say this again. I have seen From Mississippi to Montreal, a memoir by Fred Anderson, just in order to say, I think you must have been a prodigy. Somebody said, hey, keep an eye on this guy. You're 17 years old, and you got Walter Reuther and Martin Luther King and Lyndon Johnson threatening, and you're part of the group. But by the way, how did you handle that? Did you have a voice in that, or were you just watching and supporting your friends?
I was just there as part of the circle of SNCC people who were there to discuss the compromise. And SNCC, we handled it the way we always handle things. You know, we had developed this local leadership, and they were in charge. And so even when Fannie Lou Hamer looked at us as if to ask, what would you do? Our response was, not about us, it's about you. You do whatever you think is right.
Mm-hmm. And she did.
And she did.
Yeah. And by the way, now again, back to, it produced victories down the road. It was about 10 years later, was it not, that... Unita Blackwell was elected
mayor. Yeah.
And she, by the way, she came through. She paved the streets. She got plumbing and water.
She did all kinds of things. She brought in all kinds of child care centers, you know, credit unions for low-income people. She did all kinds of things.
It must have been a few. Yeah. Of the former segregationist crowd who said, why can't we do that?
Exactly. Exactly. I mean,
if Mississippi's going to be saved, they're going to need more Unita Blackwell.
Yeah. You know, and if people, you know, and if people want to pursue that more, She has an excellent memoir that's been out for years called, it's entitled Barefooting It to Freedom.
And your first encounter, she was very practical and smart with you, helping you,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
I forget, you were in a dangerous situation, and she gave you very good practical advice.
All the time. I wouldn't have survived it without her. There's no question.
Well, before we leave that, then I want to ask you about a couple of matters to do with Montreal, because your adventure took you through some strange roads. Are you optimistic when you hear that these? I think they are black Democrats who were elected in Mississippi this past November. I think it was. I don't know if you followed that, but does it appear that they're beginning to fight their way out of the corner they were put in?
Yes, it certainly appears that way. You know, but we're in a strange place. You know, we got to somehow work and lower the price for dissent. Because right now in this atmosphere, the price of dissent is very high. You know, when I talk to people, and they talk about the atmosphere, it's just they're in a situation where, and they put it this way: you're never sure of who you're talking to.
There's a rhythm in American history. Don't you feel kind of that we're going through Reconstruction, post-Reconstruction, and perhaps Reconstruction to come? I mean, it was following the Civil War, the ending of slavery.
Well, the problem with Reconstruction is that it was unfinished. It was never completed.
Exactly.
Because with the Northerners and all those people, the compromise that they made in order to hold on to the loyalty of the South,
yes,
just stopped Reconstruction in its tracks. And unfortunately, those compromises are still operative today and playing out in different ways.
Yeah, it is the same phenomenon recurring, right?
Yep.
People ought to read W.E.B. Du Bois alongside this book, Black Reconstruction.
Yeah. And I'm looking forward to PBS, you know, because his name is sticky right now, but the masterful documentary maker.
Ken Burns.
He has a new series that's being aired soon on PBS called The American Revolution. And he deals with a lot of those contradictions and yes. How things were stifled and left unresolved.
Yeah, it definitely is unresolved. It's the best thing, the most hopeful thing about America, you could say, is that it isn't finished. A couple of ideas got turned loose. All men are created equal. You folks fought for equal protection under the law, and that's like a pick and an axe to climb a mountain, I guess, because there's always a negation of it.
I think we will eventually climb out of it, but the question is, how long will it take? That's the question.
Well. Yeah, I remember the big question. That thank goodness he made it the title of his book, Martin Luther King, Why We Can't Wait. Why is all this waiting around? They say, I'm on your side, but wait.
Right, exactly.
Well, I want to ask you, by the way, please, I'm going to say this over and over. Eyes Have Seen, Baraka Books, a memoir by Fred Anderson, Mississippi to Montreal. And here you were with one of the fighters in this cause, but having to run for it because the U.S. Army decided to call you up. and that was going on across the country. Troublemakers were being drafted.
Right.
Make sure we get those guys. And of course, by the way, black troops were dying in Vietnam too. Who you know, the closer you got to the front,
by disproportionate number. Yep.
Much, yeah, because the closer they got to the front, the more you would see black and brown Americans.
The ones being shot at. And it was to a large extent the same thing with poor whites.
And they became very interested in civil rights, by the way.
Yeah.
One of the forces, no question. Now, and you very wisely and with wonderful organization, and people need to read about this, made your way to Canada, crossed that bridge, and rendezvoused with Bob Moses and a third individual whose name escapes me.
And Herman Carter,
And you found yourself in a very intense situation. I hope people read this. Here you are, all of you, very courageous and clearly brilliant in knowledge and strategy tactics for the struggle. But you were having to live in close quarters, and Bob Moses wanted to go. He intended to go to Africa, and he wanted you to go to Africa as well, right?
Yeah, well, he eventually did. You know, well, when the three of us came here, Montreal was just a stopping off point. Our goal was to get to Africa. Mm-hmm. You know, he eventually did, but Herman Carter and I remained in Montreal.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, it's almost painful to ask you about it, but it's in the book. The third gentleman came one day and said, I can't live with this guy. I'm going to go live at the Y. And the pressure was growing of, we got to go on to Tanzania. I don't know if you knew he was going to Tanzania, but that was the goal for Bob Moses.
Yeah.
And, mm-hmm. But that's a heart, you really laid it out, and I thank you for doing it, because that's tough. Three close friends, really close, but also 300 men have to break up.
Yeah, that was a difficult juncture.
It's poignant, because you all liked each other, but it was a problem, right? Bob was disappointed, I gather, that the two of you weren't going to go with him.
Well, to a degree, I mean, you know, but he also understood. You know, because he was under great pressure to get Africa, because of course he was more iconic, more famous than we were, and therefore more sought after.
Yes.
So he had to try to get to what was safer ground, which in his circumstances was Africa, and certainly not Montreal.
Yeah. By the way, it probably by accident was a good thing, because, as you say, he's most wanted in a sense.
Exactly.
And so, if you're not together, it's harder for those who are hunting to figure out.
But it worked both ways. As I say, he was certainly under more scrutiny, and he was certainly putting more effort into into catching him and us. But also, on the other hand, we were also under much more scrutiny because we were with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like the fact that you, of course, and it is a fact. I mean, when it all came to it, he drove away in a taxi, and you watched him go, and you said you were either listened to or heard in your head the song of Joe Williams, "Just a Friend."
Yeah.
I took a stiff drink, I think.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. I like being able to track your story by listening to the music, but that's another thing we've marked out here at the Taylor Report. We're going to be sure we be playing that down the road and reminding everybody to read Eyes Have Seen.
Okay.
to understand why these songs stay in people's minds, because it, when we have a little crisis, there's a song comes in our head, right?
Yeah.
And yours are great, because these are mainly blues, and the blues are so profound. I want to ask you about a gentleman who came up in your book, and the last time we spoke to you, we didn't come to him, and it strikes me Canadians ought to know something about the gentleman. That's Bernard Mergler. He was your lawyer, and a really at one of your dangerous moments in your life, when it clear signs that the hunters were closing in on you. Can you talk about him?
Yeah, well, you know, Bernard Mergler was a Jewish lawyer here in Montreal, and he handled very, very controversial cases. In fact, when it came to the FLQ crisis here in Montreal and Quebec, it was his law firm, himself and Robert Tremblay, who negotiated the terms between the FLQ and the Trudeau government.
Oh my gosh, I forgot about that.
For them to get safe passage to Cuba.
And that was Mergler.
So he had handled all kinds of controversial cases like that. And fortunately, somebody who gave him my name, gave me his name, when the crunch hit, it was his lawyering, and his advice that kept me safely in Canada. And when it came to the end, he would not take a single penny for his services.
You know, there ought to be a little monument for Bernard Mergler. I plead ignorance. I hope somebody's written, or he wrote, somebody did a memoir on him, because he had to have nerves, a real brain, and nerves of steel.
Absolutely.
Did you sense it right away when you met him that this is a guy I can trust him?
Well, yeah, because he had come highly recommended from people that I trust, and to give an example, I mean the first time I went to his office, and He didn't even allow me in the office. He closed the door and said, "Let's go for a walk." And I knew right then that he suspected and was probably quite correct that his office was under surveillance and phones were tapped and all that sort of stuff. Mm. So he said, "Let's go for a walk."
And then he's the one who said to you, "Move and move now."
Move, and move now. Yep, absolutely.
He did. As he's like, you need a black belt. No ifs, no buts.
Yeah.
Get yourself in gear. You almost lost a library, and you love books.
But you
had to do what he said.
I was in his hands. He was my lifeline. I had to follow his advice, you know?
Yeah. Been around you were really wonderful people who came through for you. Even, you know, their knowledge of you was sufficient. Not all of them knew you very well, but it was sufficient that they were ready to go out on a limb.
And they, you know, and they did. They were under a lot of pressure to give me up, you know?
It's a great story, and it really, I think it all goes back to the integrity of the original formation of SNCC. It seemed to give off an aura of credibility and conscience, and those who were part of it had a conscience.
Yeah, and you know we called it the circle of trust, because we knew, however difficult the circumstances were, that we could count on each other. And nobody would cave in on their principles. They would always do the right thing, even at great risk to themselves.
Yeah. Well, that's such a tremendous story, and it makes me hope for Hattiesburg and hope for Mississippi and pray for America. Fred Anderson, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. We've got to talk more. But I want to keep track of this, if you're agreeable, down the, as the months unfold here. The war to win back democracy for Americans, of which you're one of the outstanding soldiers. So we need to keep track, because we don't want to lose any more ground. We lost plenty of ground.
Absolutely. All right, Bill. Thanks so much.
And it's a pleasure talking to you.
Let's keep the conversation going. Have a good day.
Let's do that. Thank you very much. Fred Anderson, Eyes Have Seen, a memoir. Thank you. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. I suppose we have a little traveling music, because we might have Joe Williams. Do we have Joe Williams? We're going to hear Joe Williams, Just a Friend, coming up.